Welcome to Yarning Disability, the FPDN podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Namok Jr. I'm a proud St. Paul Badu and Caribbean man from the Torres Strait. And I'm also the son of the designer of the Torres Strait Islander flag, Bernard Namok Sr., and an advocate for the First Peoples Disability Network. Join me now on Yarning Disability as we showcase First Nations people living with a disability, as well as their families and carers, and other industry professionals.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are warned that the following podcast may contain the voices and names of people who are deceased. The First Peoples Disability Network and the producers of this podcast recognise the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past, present, and the future leaders of tomorrow. FPDN would like to acknowledge our founding elders and their lasting legacy, Uncle Lester Bostock and Auntie Gal Rankin, and acknowledge all First Peoples living with a disability.
Renee Barker-Maholland is a First Nations woman living in Nam. She has an autoimmune disease called ankylosing spondylitis. Over time, it can cause some of the bones in the spine to fuse. She's also a mother of children with disabilities, autism and ADHD. She yarned to me what it's like to navigate through life in the big cities as a First Nations person with a disability. But this hasn't stopped her from being there for her family and mob that she crossed paths with. A First Nation woman and advocate for human and disability justice. And just a heads up, the following conversation may contain some coarse language.
My name is Renee Barker-Maholland. I'm a Birrarri Dungari woman from mid-North Coast. I live on Wadawurrung country now. We moved to Nam about 15 years ago now. I'd never been here before, and we moved here, and me and my partner, and have lived and loved here ever since. But it sounds a bit like I'm a bit big note in myself, but I call myself the black of all trades because I do a lot of different things. And I think that reflects in my home life as well. Like I grew up with a parent with a disability. I grew up with a single parent as well. I lost my parents at an early age. I had a kid with a disability. Now my entire family is disabled in different ways. So I've got an autoimmune disease called ankylosing spondylitis. It's a mouthful, don't bother with it. But basically it's just, my body attacks itself and causes a lot of pain and fatigue and lack of movement and stuff like that. So that's about me. My kids are neurodivergent, so they are autistic and have ADHD, so is my husband. We sort of navigate life as we're homeschoolers as well, so we don't send our kids to a mainstream school. So we navigate sort of everything to do with life, with homeschool, navigating disability, navigating, blackness, navigating, I was talking, it was my dad's birthday recently, and he died about 15 years ago now, almost. And I said to my son, my dad would be so proud of you, how cheeky you are, because you'd be just like him. But so proud of you. And he had a little tear well up because, he hasn't got that connection and he missed out on that. And I think that's really what I try and give our family is that connection. And that's our main focus point.
I think you're saying that my youngest brother, he was 6 months when my dad passed away back in 93. And the only memory that he has of my dad is a photo of him. Yeah. And for him, like,
He didn't have the connection with my dad. For him, it was hard growing up, remembering, like, he carries a picture. When he used to be little, he used to carry a picture of my dad around. And when my mom asks him, or a couple of teachers at school ask him, like, what do you remember of dad, of your dad? And he kind of paused, that long pause, and he said, I don't have any memory. The only memory I have is this picture,
Of
the last
him.
picture of him. And like growing up with my mom being single parent, it was pretty hard, like he had to move away from the island, culture, connection, families,
Exactly, all that stuff. Yeah.
and live away, just to make that money, for us to
Otherwise,
survive.
yes, you wouldn't survive.
Yeah, but like you mentioned that you didn't have a car, public transport, and whenever there's whenever there's a car, I think always something wrong. Would you thought that there was something wrong?
Yes, whenever a car pulled up at school, there was something wrong. We didn't ever own a car, so that was a signal that, something different was happening, or some kind of trauma had happened. And that happened a lot in my life, like as a child of a single parent who, both of my parents had issues with addiction and mental illness and disability, but were, I don't hold any grudges towards them, but I understand their why they couldn't be what I needed them to be. And that it's a hard thing to learn early. It's a very hard thing to learn early. And then you start to see the bigger picture of what that disconnection does to everybody and what it does to your being and your existence and your whole family. It just, and it comes from necessity. Comes from, if I don't move, I'm not going to be able to support myself.
When my grandma used to pull up in a taxi, and at the school, me and my sister would wait at the front. She would always bring, fish and chips, or that meal that we couldn't afford. But she would always, sacrifice her pension money, so me and my sister would have like a normal lunch to other kids in school. And I remember I used to be, in year six, my mom used to live, like, back then it was bank books, and he used to have the permission slips to take out money from the bank. So my mom used to write permission slips, like a lot of permission slips, and I would send my mom her pension too. And I was like in year six, and I would walk around, with $300 in my backpack, so I could send money, because in Weipa there was no National Australia Bank. It was only Commonwealth, so I had to send the money, like, during my lunch
Oh
break.
gosh.
During my lunch break, I would take my bicycle and go to the local supermarket and send money to my mom. And I would open up my knapsack, and there would be like $50 note, and they were like, how can you be carrying all that money? But it was like, I had to learn to be independent too at a young age, and I think that kind of it shaped me who I am today.
Another thing we have in common. I used to ride on my bike with my backpack down to do, I'd do the groceries, I'd do the pay the bills and stuff like that. But I was lucky that I had brothers older than me also. So they kind of, you mentioned your younger brother didn't really have that relationship. But I did, but I had a really great relationship with my older brothers as well. But they had to step in of the place of a paternal figure for me, and kind of while they were children themselves, and try and protect me from things that were happening, bad people and bad stuff that happened. And, you know, that's something a child doesn't have to learn either, that, you know, that it's only, I mean, if I'm honest, it's only been the last couple of years that I've stopped sleeping with a metal pole behind the front door, because I'm just that damaged from the things that have happened in my life. Like, I still worry about that shit every day. I still worry about, like, my youngest child is blue haired. He doesn't have blue hair. He has blonde hair, yeah, and blue eyes. And so walking down the street, I say to him, I'd tell him the truth and say, they would have taken you from me because your skin looks so different to mine. Like, they would have taken you from me. And it's almost like I feel a sense of duty to tell them and to educate them about these things that happened, because I think everybody should know. But also, you know, they shouldn't have to think about that. They shouldn't have to think about, you know, what did I do to have to deserve a father that was so broken from what happened to him. He'd probably kill me for saying that if he was alive. He'd be like, no, don't tell him that. Like, oh, I'm fine. But see, that's the other thing too, the bravado and the constant aversion that people, that mob have to talking about shit that's hard, because it's so, you know, for so long I felt judged about my parenting, about everything. If I was, because I know I can pass for not black, like I know I have the privilege of being light-skinned, I'm aware of that, but I still have that fear all the time of judgment and of like my children being on their best behavior, or their, that fear of being, I don't even, it's just an ominous sort of like ever-present sort of feeling that every time you go out, and if you're publicly black, then, you know, be careful because you'll be judged.
It's Damien Griffiths here, the CEO of the First Peoples Disability Network, and you're listening to Yarning Disability.
So I was born in Sydney, and we spent a little bit of time like in the inner west around Redfern in the 80s and stuff, and then went out to a little town called Armidale. I don't know if you know where Armidale is. Yes, a lot of my mob still live around there. And it's very telling when you go to a big city and you walk down the street. Like, I, you know, like I've mentioned, I had a really close relationship with my brothers, and they're, you know, tall, dark and handsome. And you walk down the street with people, with them, and people will shy away from them or, you know, try and avoid them. And I'm like, it's become more obvious as I've used my wheelchair more often. The more I use my wheelchair, the more people look at me, the more people have that same kind of response that they have to dark skin mob or any person of colour, that kind of fear and that, you know. And, like, I know it's one thing I'm very grateful for that I learned from my father, a joy of black men. No, the joy of black men and seeing that, and seeing black men express themselves and be open and, you know, do all those things, and having brothers that weren't afraid to be, you know, tell me that they loved me and that they would do anything for me. And that, I think that's a really important thing that helped ground my family as well, as that conversation about connection and continuing that on as well.
In that yarn there, you mentioned your mum was also an advocate.
Like I mentioned, both my parents had issues with drugs and mental health issues. And so my mum came to advocacy as a recipient of the care. She, you know, my auntie piled her up and said, come on, I'll take you with the kids and, you know, we'll look after you and whatever. But hooked her up with the local neighbourhood centre, and that's where she was like, well, I can see I can make a difference here. And she started just at the local neighborhood center. She would help other people that she knew from around town, like, advocate that way. And then after a few years, they gave her a job. And so she became part of the Department of Housing. And so she'd liaise in between tenants and them, or because they knew that she had Aboriginal children, mob felt comfortable talking to her and sort of using that platform of hers to try and redress the balance of things that have been happening. You know, like she was there on the bridge in 88. She marched. I don't want to paint her as like this amazing saviour, but, you know, that's where it started from, this understanding of what had been happened and what needs to be fixed.
Yeah, and I think Mob don't realise, like, especially for myself, like with my personal experience, like I've seen how, you know, the system here in Cairns kind of like put big words, you know, and without having an interpreter there, because English for Mob, especially up here in far north Queensland, it's second or third. And especially in my brother's case, you know, like they didn't even offer, you know, like Aboriginal liaison officer to break the big words down for my mum. And lucky I stepped in at the right time, because, you know, like growing up too, like I didn't realize that advocating for my dad and the flag happened at a young age. I've always grown up, you know, like if things were to be out in the papers, negative story around the Torres Strait flag, I would kind of jump in and, you know, like say this and that, but defend. But then I put it in a different perspective, you know, like I educate people at the same time. Whereas my mom, you know, like I kind of stepped in and I said to the social worker, like my mom, she had the confusion look on her face. And from that experience, you know, and kind of opened my eyes to accessibility up on the islands. If you're not comfortable signing that form, you don't have to.
Yes.
You know, because you're signing over, you don't know what you're signing over to them. You might be signing over your rights for them to do and act upon my brother without your permission. Because consulting the family. So
yeah.
And then that kind of the, you know, the advocating kind of stepped in.
Gets me angry too, because you shouldn't have to be dealing with that. You're dealing with something emotional and hard and triggering yourself. And then, you know, I know culturally for us it's the kind of expected that we step in and support. And I would love to, and I'm happy to. But in a situation like that where the dominant culture and the person in control is going to be someone who's not within your culture, I really think that people need to do a better job in general in terms of that. It's really lacking in terms of culture, but also disability and culture together. It's like sometimes I feel like I have to choose, like be black or be a disabled person. Like it's not, I can't have a culturally appropriate wheelchair, or you know what I mean. Like this, I feel like I have to choose between one or the other. I think I was lucky in that not only I learned to advocate from my mum, but my dad has like 8 siblings. So. And a couple of them have worked within the health system. There's a couple of doctors in there. There's a couple of solicitors in there. And so, you know, at the age of 16, I got the phone call that my dad had fallen into a coma, and then they weren't sure that he was going to live. And, you know, I was little 16-year-old me turned up, and I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and he was, you know, laying in bed in front of me. And I had another exposure to that kind of that cultural advocation from my aunties, from them saying, you know, this is what's going to happen. If he's not going to survive, then this is what, and this is what's going to happen. And, you know, I've never been afraid of asking. I always got told, you know, the worst they can say is no. So, you know, and you know worse off than where you were. So that kind of push towards a natural, I'm trying to politely say that my mum and my dad were both really hard-headed and wouldn't give up, and I think I just inherited that. And you know, it just is something that I feel really passionate about.
And also, like, it takes one person, like, to tell that story. And then, well, from my experience, you know, once I told that story, you know, on social media, and then all the mob up on the island started coming out with their story. And I think they kind of waited for that one person, and then they would continue, or then they would feel comfortable without having to be that troublemaker, you know?
I don't mind being the troublemaker, eh?
I was told, not to sit back and wait. You got to chase. If you want an answer, you just got to chase, eh?
Don't wait for someone to give it to you because it probably won't happen.
So what's life like for you now with your kids and
I really enjoy doing things like this. And I really enjoy talking because I think our history is in our stories. And if I don't tell the story, there's a wonderful story of my father who was used to use a wheelchair for the last 10 years of his life. A wonderful story about him driving down in a wheelchair. He was buck naked, like he had no clothes on at all, in his wheelchair driving down the street. And the copper was, well aware of who he was, and said, "David, what are you doing? Why haven't you got any clothes on?" And he goes, "Oh, it's my cultural practice. I'm not supposed to wear any clothes." And like the cop knew he was taking the piss, but it's just those little stories about people that keep them alive. And I think stories of people with disability being openly like, I don't care who sees me in a wheelchair. I don't care who sees me being openly disabled or stumbling on my words or forgetting things or whatever. Like I've got a reason for that, and I'm not ashamed of that, and there should be no shame about it. Like it ties into this whole idea that we should be an ideal, and there is no ideal. We're all individuals. Even twins are not. I mean, they might be exactly the same, but they have different experiences and stuff, and they're all very valuable and all very worthy of being shared. But I think particularly mob with disability have so much to teach people.
And I think like telling stories too without, some mobs still have that shame factor, and but if you don't share your story, then how would people know?
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but telling a story can be a really powerful thing for me. Just telling it, just having someone listen to my story and say, "That is crap," or "That is awesome," or "That's whatever it is," but just having someone listen. And I've had a lot of shame about my body, not about my disability, but about my body. And it really has been a case of just taking the first step. Take the first step and sort of put yourself out there, I think is the thing. That's the hardest thing to do because, I'm sure as you've had experience with negative media and a lot of negative media, how disheartening it can be and how terrible it can be, but also that connection. Like you and I have connected because of somebody that I told my story to. You know what I mean? That's and now I feel like I've got another ally that knows my experience and knows what it's like, and that I have another. I mean, what I'd met you 10 minutes and I was already asking you for help because that to me, that's the essence of what a community is, and whether that's a disability community, the black community, whatever, wherever the community is, if we feel that connection with someone, it's going to make life a lot easier.
Yeah, because I only heard your first part of the yarn that you did, and that part about that public transport, and then I started having all these flashbacks, of me in year five up on the islands waiting for my grandma to come around, and and then that next thing I remembered was my mom having to leave and walk around in that backpack full of $50 notes. Just from listening to your part of your first half of the yarn that you did. It's weird, eh?
I think those little moments are what help people. They really do. One of the biggest things that I feel is that I'm the only person that feels like this. But I'm really not. There's like a million, probably a million other people that feel the same way as I do. It's just finding that connection. And like you said, finding that right spot to be like, oh yeah, I connect with that, you know. But also the joyful connections, you know, not just the hard traumas and the, but what an amazing, you know, connection you had with your grandmother. And what an amazing thing to see her be able to prepare food and, you know, have those really simple, well, not simple, fundamental things about life, you know, those really things that make you feel good on the inside when you remember them.
And if there's mob listening to this yarn, and having, just having doubts or don't know where to go or what direction, what would you say to them?
I honestly, I would direct them to you, Forrest. I'd direct them to mob controlled, let's put it in a way they'll understand, to their local community. Find someone in their community. And if that community is online, that's okay too. You know, it doesn't have to be in person. It's just making that connection with somebody. But yeah, definitely. First People's Disability Network. I know Aunty June. Just knowing that she's part of that and that you're part of that network. I think what I'm trying to say is it doesn't really matter who you reach out to, but reach out to someone. And if you get knocked back or if it's not what you need, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know, just it
Try
you,
again.
yes. Like, I don't know. I'll use a metaphor. When you buy clothes, right? Off the rack. They're all designed for one person. There's one person. They take the measurements of that person. They don't fit them for your uncle's leg that got shortened after he had that accident. Or, you know, they don't fit them for your sister who's got one boob that's bigger than the other. Like, it's just a one size fits all. So don't be afraid to look for or to go, oh, that might not fit me perfectly, but let's see if we can sort of just use it until we can get to the next part. Or adaptability, I think, is what I'm getting at, which we're already really good at. I think mob are all natural storytellers too, and the never underestimate the power of listening to someone's story and believing them, I think. So that's what I would tell anyone listening too. If you think you're disabled and you're not sure whether you should say you are disabled, you are. You know, this idea of listening to people or people with around negative media and comments and things like that. My mum had a really great saying, for those who believe, no proof is necessary. And for those who don't believe, no proof is possible. So, you know, there's going to be people out there that will hate you no matter what you do. And there's going to be people out there that love you no matter what you do. So, you know, you and remind yourself who, you know, who you are. Connected to the oldest living culture in the entire world. Like, if that's not something to be amazed and proud about, I don't know what is.
Thanks to Renee Barker-Mulholland for sharing her family story on Yarning Disability. If there's anything you heard in today's episode that raises concerns for you, there is help available. You can contact 13YARN on 13 92 76 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. Thanks for listening to Yarning Disability. I'm your host, Bernard Namok Jr. Follow FPDN on our social media accounts to stay up to date with future episodes and information. You can also visit our website at www.fpdn.org.au.